be your death warrant, my father said on the day I received my learner's permit. You're going to get out there and kill someone, and the guilt is going to tear your heart out. The thought of killing myself had slowed me down to 5 miles per hour. The thought of killing someone else stopped me completely. My mother had picked me up from a play rehearsal one rainy night when, cresting a hill, the car ran over something it shouldn't have. This was not a brick or a misplaced boot, but some living creature that cried out when caught beneath the tire. Shit, my mother whispered, tapping her forehead against the steering wheel. Shit, shit, shit. We covered our heads against the rain and searched the darkened street until we found an orange cat coughing up blood into the gutter.
You killed me, the cat said, pointing at my mother with its flattened paw. Here I had so much to live for, but now it's over, my whole life wiped out, just like that.
The cat wheezed rhythmically before closing its eyes and dying. Shit, my mother repeated. We walked door to door until finding the cat's owner, a kind and understanding woman whose young daughter shared none of her qualities.
You killed my cat, she screamed, sobbing into her mother's skirt. You're mean, and you're ugly, and you killed my cat.
She's at that age, the mother said, stroking the child's hair. My mother felt bad enough without the lecture that awaited her at home.
That could have been a child, my father shouted. Think about that the next time you're tearing down the street searching for kicks.
He made it sound as if my mother ran down cats for sport.
You think this is funny, he said, but we'll see who's laughing when you're behind bars awaiting trial for manslaughter.
I received a variation on the same speech after sideswiping a mailbox. Despite my mother's encouragement, I surrendered my permit and never drove again. My nerves just couldn't take it. It seemed much safer to hitchhike. My father objected when I moved to Chicago and waged a full-fledged campaign of terror when I announced I would be moving to New York.
New York, are you out of your mind? You might as well take a razor to your throat, because let me tell you something, those New Yorkers are going to eat you alive.
He spoke of friends who had been robbed and bludgeoned by packs of roving gangs, and sent me newspaper clippings detailing the tragic slayings of joggers and vacationing tourists. This could be you, he wrote in the margins. I'd lived in New York for several years when, traveling upstate to attend a wedding, I stopped in my father's hometown. We hadn't visited since our grandmother moved in with us, and I felt my way around with a creepy familiarity. I found my father's old apartment, but his friend's shoe store had been converted into a pool hall. When I called to tell him about it, my father said,
"What shoe store? What are you talking about?"
"The place where your friend worked," I said. You remember, the guy whose eye you shot out.
Frank? I didn't shoot his eye out. The guy was born that way.
My father visits me now in New York. We'll walk through Washington Square, where he'll yell,
"Get a look at the ugly mug on that one,"
referring to a 300-pound biker with grinning skulls tattooed like a choker around his neck. A young man in Central Park is photographing his girlfriend, and my father races to throw himself into the picture.
All right, sweetheart, he says, placing his arm around the startled victim. It's time to get comfortable.
I cower as he marches into posh grocery stores demanding to speak to the manager.
Back home, I can get this exact same cantaloupe for less than half this price, he says.
The managers invariably suggest that he do just that. He screams at waiters and cuts in line at Tony restaurants. I have a friend, I tell him, who lost his right hand snapping his fingers at a waiter.
Oh, you kids, he says. Not a one of you has so much as a teaspoon of gumption. I don't know where you get it from, but in the end, it's gonna kill you.
True Detective. My mother had a thing for detectives, be they old, blind, or paralyzed from the waist down, she just couldn't get enough. My older sister shared her interest. Detective worship became something they practiced together, swapping plot lines the way other mothers and daughters exchanged recipes or grooming tips. One television program would end, and then the next would begin, filling our house with the constant din of gunfire and squealing tires. Downstairs, the obese detective would collect his breath on the bow of the drug lord's pleasure craft, while up in the kitchen, his elderly colleague hurled himself over a low brick wall in pursuit of the baby-faced serial killer.
"How's your case coming?" my mother would shout during commercial breaks.
Cupping her hands to the sides of her mouth, Lisa would yell,
"Tubby's still tracking down leads, but I'm betting it's the Chinese guy with the eye patch and the ponytail."
Theirs was a world of obvious suspects. Looking for the axe murderer? Try the emotionally disturbed lumberjack loitering near the tool shed behind the victim's house. Who kidnapped the guidance counselor? Perhaps it's the 30-year-old 10th grader with a gym bag full of bloody rope. It was no wonder these cases were solved so quickly. Every clue was italicized with a burst of surging trumpets, and under questioning, the suspects snapped like toothpicks, buckling in less time than it took to soft-boil an egg. "You want to know who set fire to the retirement home? All right, it was me. You satisfied now? That's right, me. I did it. Me." It's easy to solve a case when none of the suspects are capable of telling a decent lie. Television took the bite out of crime, leaving the detective as nothing more than a lifestyle. It seemed that anyone could solve a murder as long as they had a telephone, a few hours of spare time, and a wet bar. My mother had all these ingredients in spades. The more suspects she identified over the course of a season, the more confident she became. Together, she and my sister would comb the local newspaper, speculating on each reported crime.
"We know that the girl was held at knife point on the second floor of her house."
Lisa tapped a pencil against her forehead.
"So probably the person who robbed her was not in a wheelchair."
"I'd say that's a pretty safe assumption," my mother answered. "While you're at it, I think we might as well eliminate anyone confined to an iron lung." Vandalism at 318 Pool Road, breaking and entering at the Five Points Pharmacy, a hit-and-run traffic accident in the parking lot of Swain's Steakhouse. It was always the work of a drug addict or a former police officer, a renegade, a rogue. To hear my mother talk, you'd think the sunny, manicured streets of suburban Raleigh were crawling with heroin addicts, the needles poking through the sleeves of their tattered police uniforms. It embarrassed me to hear her use phrases like copping a fix or the pusher man. "I have to go now," she'd say to the grocery clerk. "My mother-in-law is back at the house, jonesing for her lunch." "I beg your pardon," they'd say. "Come again?" Only on network television did people talk this way.
"I call the TV," my mother and sister would say.
It didn't matter what you were watching. When they laid claim to one of the televisions, you surrendered it the same way cars gave up the road at the sight of an advancing ambulance. I couldn't bear the detective shows, but made it a point to regularly check in with the fugitive. This was a story of Dr. Richard Kimball, a man on the run, falsely accused of a crime he did not commit. We were told in the opening credits that he changed his name and his identity. The notion of identity was illustrated by a can of shoe polish sitting on what appeared to be the scuffed surface of a motel dresser. This had me stumped for months. What, I asked, would nobody recognize him with freshly shined shoes? Did he use it to blacken his face? I don't get it.
His hair, stupid. He used it to dye his hair.
Lisa liked the fugitive because she said,
"He's easy on the eyes."
The way she saw it, Dr. Kimball needed only two things, a one-armed suspect and the love of a good woman. She failed to understand that despite his brooding good looks, a man of his nature could never be happy. Unlike her nightly lineup of swaggering gumshoes, the fugitive had both a soul and a memory, and would remain a haunted man long after his wife's true killer had been brought to justice. Most programs discouraged you from concentrating on the hero's dark inner workings. If his girlfriend was gunned down at a makeup table, you knew there'd be another one to replace her, no questions asked. The fugitive had no fancy convertible or stylish wet bar. He was cut from a different kind of cloth, my kind of cloth, the itchy kind. Lisa wouldn't know a sensitive loner if he crawled into her lap with a fistful of daisies, and it annoyed me when she labeled the fugitive as her kind of a show. It was one thing to sit in front of the television, second-guessing a third-rate detective program, but quite another to solve a real case. We were well into our summer reruns when our household was shaken by a series of very real crimes no TV detective could ever hope to crack. Someone in our family had taken to wiping his or her ass on the bath towels. What made this exceptionally disturbing was that all of our towels were fudge-colored. You'd be drying your hair when, too late, you'd notice an unmistakable odor on your hands, head, and face. If nothing else, life in the suburbs promised that you might go from day to day without finding shit in your hair. This sudden turn of events tested our resolve to the core, leaving us to wonder who we were and where we, as a people, had gone wrong. Soul-searching aside, it also called for plenty of hot water, gallons of shampoo, steel wool, industrial scrub brushes, and blocks of harsh deodorizing soap. The criminal hit all three bathrooms, pausing just long enough to convince the rest of us that it was finally safe to let down our guard. I might spend 20 minutes carefully sniffing the towel, only to discover that this time the asshole had used the washcloth. My mother thumbed through the newspaper early one Sunday morning. "Well, the person doing this is one sick individual, that much we know for certain."
"And they eat corn,"
Lisa added, patting her head with the T-shirt. The most recent victim, she had washed her hair so many times it now resembled the wiry, synthetic mane of a troll doll. Everybody had their theories, but nobody had any hard evidence. Discounting my parents, that still left six children and my grandmother, all possible suspects. I eliminated myself, and because the towels were carefully folded, I excused my brother, who, to this day, cannot manage such a complex activity. It must smart to use a towel for such a delicate purpose. I watched as my family took their seats at the table, waiting for someone to cry out or flinch, but nothing came of it. My mother and sister had always thought themselves so wily and smart, but when pressed for a suspect, they said only that this case was beneath them. If someone were to be murdered or kidnapped, they'd rise to the occasion and finger the guilty party within an hour. This particular case fell under the category of aggravated mischief and was therefore unworthy of their professional attention. Whoever it was would listen to their conscience and confess sooner or later. In the meantime, my mother would stock the linen closet with white towels. Case closed. Later that month, someone went through my father's top drawer, stealing a knee sock packed with 112 Liberty Silver dollars. I knew my father's drawers as well as I knew my own. Everyone did. That was how you occupied your time when you had the house to yourself. You rifled through my father's drawers before moving on to a second hiding space in the shed. I had seen and counted these coins many times. We all had. But who would go so far as to steal them? My father gathered us all in the dining room and listened as we each took turns denying any involvement.
"Dollars come in silver? I never knew that."
"Does the government issue them in a knee sock, or was that your idea?" "Okay," my father said. "All right, I understand now. Nobody took my coins. I guess they just got tired of living cooped up in that dresser and decided to roll out the door and spend themselves on candy and magazines. That's what happened, isn't it? Oh, they're probably out there as we speak, having themselves a grand old time, aren't they?" His voice visited its highest register, and he rubbed his hands together as if he were considering a tray of rich desserts. "Free at last, with their whole lives ahead of them. Can't you just feel the excitement? Doesn't it just make you want to throw up your hands and scream?" He lowered his voice and delivered a series of ultimatums I didn't quite catch. My mind was snagged on the thought of those jubilant silver dollars, raucous and dizzy with their first feelings of independence. I pictured their splitting into groups and traveling by night to avoid any excess attention. It might prove difficult to roll over grass and leaves, so I imagined them huddled together in the carport, deciding it best to stick to the roads and sidewalks. The thought of it made me laugh, and when I did, my father said, "You think this is funny? You getting a chuckle out of this, are you? I'm glad you find it so amusing. Let's see how funny it is when we search your room, funny guy." On television, a search warrant guaranteed that your home would be trashed, and this was no different. Mine was the only clean room in the entire house. This was my shrine, my temple, and I watched in horror as my drawers were emptied and my closets brutally divorced of order. While searching my desk, my father came across a gold-plated mechanical pencil he recognized as his own. It had once occupied the same drawer as his coins, and I admitted that, yes, I had taken the pencil, but I hadn't really stolen it. There was a big difference between the two. You steal things that you covet, while you take things the original owner is incapable of appreciating. The pencil had spoken to me of its neglect, and I had offered to put it to good use. Taking is just borrowing without the formality. I'd planned on returning it once it ran out of lead. What was the big deal? This wasn't the sort of case-busting clue he was making it out to be. There were no blaring trumpets or high-speed chases, just a lousy pencil I'd used only in order to make me feel important. The moment my father and his pencil were reunited, I became the prime suspect, tried and convicted on circumstantial evidence. There was nothing I could say or do to change his mind. Falsely convicted of a crime I did not commit, there was only one thing I could do. The shoe polish was kept in the linen closet. I chose black, massaging it into my scalp in an attempt to change my identity. The fugitive's hair always looked perfectly natural. It blew in the breeze created by oncoming trucks as he stood beside the lonesome road, bidding farewell to a town unable to appreciate his unique gifts. My natural hair looked pretty much the same way. But once the polish dried, my hair hardened into a stiff, unified mass that covered my head like a helmet. I went to bed and awoke to find my sheets and pillows smudged and ruined. My face and arms were bruised-looking, and everything stank with the rigid, military odor of a buffing rag. It was no wonder the fugitive was a loner. I liked the sheen and color of my hair, but found I needed to slick it back in order to maintain a clean forehead. This hair of mine was bulletproof. You could have pounded my head with a golf club and I wouldn't have felt a thing. I carried my soiled sheets into the woods, knowing that from here on out, things were going to be different. I had crossed over the edge and there was no turning back. After I changed my identity, the next step was to find the real thief and clear my name. My mother and sister were fond of saying, "The criminal always returns to the scene of the crime." This was a bit of dime store wisdom picked up from one of their television programs, but I thought it might be worth a try. It was certainly true of whoever was wiping their ass on the towels, but then again, they had no choice. The bathroom was where we kept our toilet, and even if the criminal had changed their ways, they'd still need to use the john. Aside from the silver dollars, my father's drawers were home to several pocket watches, a pair of cufflinks shaped like dice, tie clips, fine cigarette lighters, and a deck of nudie playing cards missing both the King of Hearts and the Ace of Clubs. Figuring the thief had good reason to return for more, I undertook a stakeout. My father's closet had shuttered, louvered doors that afforded a view of the entire room. I took my place, waiting a full hour before my mother entered the room shouting, "I don't give a tinker's damn what they do on Mount Olympus. In this house, you don't boil a $7 steak." My intuition told me that she was talking to my grandmother. Slamming the door behind her, she took a seat on the edge of the unmade bed. She stared down at her bare feet, and then, as if she expected them to apologize for some trouble they'd recently caused, said, "Well, what have we got to say for ourselves?" She picked at her toenail for a moment before crossing the room to fetch a bottle of glossy polish from the top of her dresser. This was a new shade, the color of putty. Rather than highlighting the nails, it caused them to disappear into the surrounding flesh, creating a look both freakish and popular. I'd never understood why women bothered painting their toenails. especially my mother, whose crusty, misshapen talons resembled the shattered, nugget-sized Fritos found huddled at the bottom of the bag. She stood before the mirror, shaking the bottle and fretting at the sight of her brittle, frosted hair, arranged into a listless style she referred to as the devil's stomping ground. I watched then as she rummaged through her closet, returning with a tall plastic box secured with the sort of latches you might find on a suitcase. I'd been through my father's closet thousands of times, but never my mother's. "If I had something of value, this is the last place I'd put it," she'd say. "The goddamn Maws don't even want what I've got." My father's closet and dresser drawers offered clues to his inner life. I enjoyed uncovering what I thought to be his secrets, but felt it best to honor my mother's privacy, not out of respect so much as fear. I didn't want any possible handcuffs or hooded leather mask interfering with the notion that this woman was first and foremost my mother. She carried the box to her dresser and unfastened the latches, lifting the lid to reveal a pale, styrofoam head supporting a sandy blonde wig, the hair sculpted into a series of cresting waves. This was a magnificent crown of hair, so perfect that it might have been styled by God himself on one of those off days he was feeling creative rather than vengeful. After carefully removing the pins, my mother placed the wig upon her head and studied herself in the mirror. She nodded her head this way and that, but the curls, defying all laws of physics, held their position. I knew the feeling, except that my rigid hairstyle was by this time basically cemented to my scalp. Fumes from the shoe polish were making me nauseous, and I had begun to perspire, the inky sweat running down my forehead and staining my shirt. "What do you say to that, missy?" my mother asked herself. She applied a coat of lipstick and brought her face close to the mirror, cocking her head and arching her eyebrows in a series of expressions that conveyed everything from heartfelt concern to full-throttle rage. Then she stepped away from the mirror, reintroducing herself slowly, as if her reflection were a guest she was meeting for the first time. I often did the same thing myself in the privacy of the bathroom. "Who's he?" I'd ask, admiring myself with a new shirt or haircut. Most often my private sessions would end with my pants in a tangle around my ankles. Would my mother now unbutton her blouse? Would she lift her skirt and excite herself? At what point would I call out and put an end to this? How could I live with myself knowing what she looked like naked? "Please," I thought, "don't do it. Don't be like me." "All right, then," my mother said. "What do you say we paint these toenails?" Opening the jar, she took a seat on the edge of the bed. I watched then as she parted her toes and set to work, pausing every so often to regard herself in the mirror. She finished the right foot and then held it out for inspection. When the left foot was finished, she tossed the polish onto the dresser and fashioned a mound out of pillows, something so high that she could lie on her back without crushing her wig. It looked uncomfortable, but she seemed used to it. Spreading out her arms and legs, she closed her eyes and reclined as best she could. The room, with its unmade bed and cigarette packets littering the floor, resembled a crime scene. She might have been a nightclub hostess strangled for knowing too much, or a career woman who choked on her popcorn while watching the late movie. How strange to put on a wig, to change into someone else, and then lie down and take a nap. Was she dreaming of all the exotic things this character might do, or was her wig nothing more than a high-maintenance sleeping cap? Television stakeouts tend to reduce the hours of monotonous waiting into a single moment of truth. The detective arrives just in time to overhear the ransom instructions or catch the jewel thieves studying the blueprints to the museum. I stood for an hour with a head full of shoe polish, a fugitive, watching my mother asleep in disguise and waiting for something to reveal itself. After she'd woken up, my mother returned her wig to its hiding place and left the room. I waited for a few minutes and then crept downstairs, where I washed my hair three times, taking care to rinse the tub with Comet and destroy my soiled shirt.
At the sound of my father's footsteps coming through the front door, I darted into my bedroom, slapping my face and examining my reflection in the darkened window. I wanted to be apple-cheeked, looking fresh and innocent when he rounded up the usual suspects, herding us into the dining room in an attempt to solve the greatest mystery of all. Who had smeared his shirts and jackets with shoe polish? When the time came, I'd take my seat beside the same crooks who had stolen the coins and wiped themselves on the towels and say, "Did you say shoe polish? On your suits? Today? No. Sorry. I wouldn't know anything about that." The Drama Bug. The man was sent to our class to inspire us, and personally speaking, I thought he did an excellent job. After introducing himself in a relaxed and genial manner, he started towards the back of the room, only to be stopped midway by what we came to know as the invisible wall, that transparent barrier realized only by psychotics, drug fiends, and other members of the show business community. You know you're living in a small town when you can reach the ninth grade without ever having seen a mime. As far as I was concerned, this man was a prophet, a genius, a pioneer in the field of entertainment, and here he was in Raleigh, North Carolina. I went home and demonstrated the invisible wall for my two-year-old brother, who pounded on the very real wall beside his playpen, shrieking and wailing in disgust. When my mother asked what I'd done to provoke him, I threw up my hands in mock innocence before lowering them to retrieve the imaginary baby that lay fussing at my feet. I patted the back of my little ghost to induce gas and was investigating its soiled diaper when I noticed my mother's face assume an expression she reserved for unspeakable horror. I had seen this look only twice before, once when she was caught in the path of a charging, rabid pig, and then again when I told her I wanted a peach-colored velveteen blazer with matching slacks. "I don't know who put you up to this," she said, "but I'll kill you myself before I watch you grow up to be a clown." Fearful of a retribution, I did as I was told, ending my career in mime with the whimper rather than the silent bang I had hoped for. The visiting actor returned to our classroom a few months later. This afternoon's task was to introduce us to the works of William Shakespeare, and once again I was completely captivated by his charm and skill. It seemed a shame that people no longer spoke this way, and I undertook a campaign to reintroduce Elizabethan English to the citizens of Raleigh, North Carolina. "Perchance, fair lady, thou dost think me unduly vexed by the sorrowful state of thine quarters," I said to my mother as I ran the vacuum cleaner over the living room carpet she was inherently too lazy to bother with. "These foul specks, the evidence of life itself, have sullied not only thine shag-tempered mat, but also thine character, be ye mad, woman. Were it a punishable crime to neglect thine dwellings, you, my feeble-spirited mistress, would hang from the tallest tree in penance for your shameful ways. Be there not garments to launder and iron free of turbulence? See ye not the porcelain plates and hearty mugs waiting to be washed clean of evidence? Get thee to thine work, damnable lady, and quickly, before the products of thine very loins raise their collected fists in a spirit born both of rage and indignation, forcibly coaxing the last breath from the foul chamber of thine vain and upright throat." My mother reacted as if I had whipped her with a short length of yarn. The intent was there, but the weapon was strange and inadequate. I could tell by the state of my room that she spent the next day searching my dresser for drugs. I took to brooding, refusing to let up until I received a copy of Shakespeare's collected plays. Once they were acquired, I discovered them dense and difficult to follow. Reading the words made me feel dull and stupid, but speaking them made me feel powerful. I found it best to simply carry the book from room to room, occasionally skimming for fun words I might toss into my ever-fragrant vocabulary. The dinner hour became either unbearable or excruciating, depending upon my mood. Methinks, kind sir, most gentle lady, fellow siblings all, that this barnyard fowl be most tasty and succulent, having simmered in its own sweet juices for such a time as it might take the sun to pass, rosy and full-fingered across a plum-colored sky for the course of a twilight hour. 'Tis crisp yet juicy, this plump bird, satisfied in the company of such finely roasted neighbors. Hear me out, fine relations, and heed my words, for me thinks it adventurous, and fanciful too, to saddle mine fork with both fowl and carrot at the exact same time, the twin juices blending together in a delicate harmony which doth cajole and enliven mine tongue in a spirit of unbridled merriment. What say ye, fine father, sisters, and infant brother too, that we raise our flagons high in celebration of this hearty feast, prepared lovingly and with utmost grace by this dutiful woman we have the good fortune to address as wife, wench, or mother. I was at the orthodontist's office, placing a pox upon the practice of dentistry, when the visiting actor returned to our classroom.
You missed it,
my friend Lois said.
The man was so indescribably powerful that I was practically crying. That's how brilliant he was.
She positioned her hands as though she were supporting a tray.
I don't know what more I can say. The words, they just don't exist.
My mother'd done some asking around and concluded I'd been bitten by what her sister referred to as the drama bug. My mother was convinced that this was a phase, just like all the others. A few weeks of fanfare and I'd drop show business, just like I had the guitar in my private detective agency. I hated having my life's ambition reduced to the level of a common cold. The drama bug seemed to strike hardest with Jews, homosexuals, and portly girls whose faces were caked with acne medication. These were individuals who, for one reason or another, desperately craved attention. I would later discover it was a bad idea to gather more than two of these people in an enclosed area for any length of time. The stage was not only a physical place, but also a state of mind, and the word audience was defined as anyone forced to suffer your company. We young actors were a string of light bulbs left burning 24 hours a day, exhausting ourselves and others with our self-proclaimed brilliance. I had the drama bug, and Lois had a car. I called her the moment I learned the visiting actor had scheduled a production of Hamlet, set to take place in the amphitheater of the Raleigh Rose Garden. He himself would direct and play the title role, but the other parts were up for grabs. We auditioned, and because we were the youngest and least experienced, Lois and I were assigned the roles of the traveling players Hamlet uses to bait his Uncle Claudius. It wasn't the part I was hoping for, but I accepted my role with quiet dignity. I had a few decent speeches and planned to work them to the best of my ability. Our fellow cast members were in their 20s and 30s and had wet their feet in such long-running outdoor dramas as The Lost Colony and Tender as the Lamb. These were professionals, and I hoped to benefit from their experience. I worshipped these people. Lois slept with them. By the second week of rehearsal, she had abandoned Fortinbras in favor of Laertes, who, she claimed, had a real way with the sword. Unlike me, she was embraced by the older crowd, attending late-night keg parties with Polonius and Ophelia, and driving to the lake with the director while Gertrude and Rosencrantz made out in the back seat. The killer was that Lois was nowhere near as committed as I was. Her drama bug was the equivalent of a 24-hour flu, yet there she was playing bumper pool with Hamlet himself while I practiced lines alone in my room, dreaming up little ways to steal the show. It was decided that as traveling players, Lois and I would make our entrance tumbling onto the outdoor stage. When she complained that the grass was irritating her skin, the director examined the wee pimples on her back and decided that, from this point on, the players would enter skipping. He'd already cut out all of my speeches, leaving me with one line, "Aye, my lord." That was it, three lousy syllables. A person could wrench more emotion out of a sneeze than all my dialogue put together. While the other actors strolled the Rose Garden, memorizing their vengeful soliloquies, I skipped back and forth across the parking lot, repeating, "Aye, my lord! Aye, my lord!" in a voice that increasingly sounded like that of a trained parrot.
Lois felt silly skipping and spoke to the director, who praised her instincts and announced that, henceforth, the players would enter walking. When it came time for our big scene, Lois recited her lines as if she were reading the words from the surface of some distant billboard. She squinted and paused between syllables, punctuating each word with a question mark.
Who, this? Has seen with tongue? In venom steeped?
If the director had a problem with her performance, he kept it to himself. I, on the other hand, I was instructed to remove the sweater from around my neck, walk slower, and drop the accent. By this time, I was finding my own way home from rehearsal. Lois couldn't give me a ride as she was always running off to some party or restaurant with what she referred to as the gang from Elsinore. I can't go, I'd say, pretending I'd been invited. I really need to go home and concentrate on my line. You go ahead, though. I'll just call my mother. She'll pick me up. Are we vexed? My mother would ask, pulling her station wagon into the parking lot. We are indeed, I answered, and highly so. Let it go, she said. 10 years from now, I guarantee you won't remember any of these people. Enough liquor and people can forget anything. Don't let it get to you. If nothing else, this has taught you how to skim money while buying their drinks. My mother had the vengeful part down. It was the craft of acting I thought she knew nothing about. We were in dress rehearsal when the director approached Lois regarding a new production he hoped to stage that coming fall. It was to be a musical based on the lives of roving gypsies. And you, he said, you shall be my lusty bandit queen. Lois couldn't sing. Everyone knew that. Neither could she act or play the tambourine. When I expressed an interest, he suggested I might enjoy working behind the scenes. He meant for me to hang lights or lug scenery, to become one of those guys with the low-riding pants, their tool belts burdened with heavy wrenches and thick rolls of gaffer's tape. Anyone thinking I might be trusted with electrical wiring had to be a complete idiot, and that's what this man was. I looked at him clearly then, noticing the way his tights made a mockery of his slack calves and dumpy little basket. Vibrant soul of a nomad indeed. If he was such a big stinking deal, what was he doing in Raleigh? His blow-dried hair, the cheap Cuban-heeled shoes and rainbow-striped suspenders, it was all a sham. Why wear tights with suspenders when their only redeeming feature was that they stayed up on their own? That's how they got their name, tights. And acting, the man performed as if the audience were deaf. He shouted his lines, grinning like a jack-o'-lantern, and flailing his arms as if his sleeves were on fire. Somewhere he had a mother who sifted through a shoebox of mimeographed playbills, pouring herself another drink and wondering when her son would come to his senses and swallow some drain cleaner. I finally saw Hamlet for who he was, and recognized myself as the witless Yorick who had blindly followed along behind him. My mother attended the opening night performance. Following my leaden, aye, my lord. I laid upon the grassy stage as Lois poured a false vial of poison into my ear. As I lay dying, I opened my eyes just a crack, catching sight of my mother stretched out on her hard stone pew, fighting off the moths that, along with a few dozen seniors, had been attracted by the light. There was a cast party afterwards, but I didn't go. I changed my clothes in the dressing room where the actors stood congratulating one another, repeating the words brilliant and intense as if they were describing the footlights. You were the best in the whole show, my mother said, stopping for frozen pizza on our way home. I mean it. You walked out onto that stage and all eyes went right to you. It occurred to me then that my mother was a better actor than I could ever hope to be. Acting is different than posing or pretending. When done with precision, it bears a striking resemblance to lying. Stripped of the costumes and grand gestures, it presents itself as an unquestionable truth. I didn't envy my mother's skill. Neither did I contradict her. That's how convincing she was. It seemed best, sitting beside her with the frozen pizza thawing on my lap, to simply sit back and learn. I like guys. Shortly before I graduated from eighth grade, it was announced that come fall, our county school system would adopt a policy of racial integration by way of forced busing. My Spanish teacher broke the news in a way she hoped might lead us to a greater understanding of her beauty and generosity.
I remember the time I was at the state fair standing in line for a snow cone.
She fingered the kiss curls that framed her squat, compact face.
And a little colored girl ran up and tugged at my skirt, asking if she could touch my hair. Just once, she said. Just one time for good luck. Now, I don't know about the rest of you, but my hair means a lot to me.
The members of my class nodded to signify that their hair meant a lot to them as well. They inched forward in their seats, eager to know where this story might be going. Perhaps a little Negro girl was holding a concealed razor blade. Maybe she was one of the troublemakers out for fresh white scalp. I sat marveling at their naivete. Like all her previous anecdotes, this woman's story was headed straight up her ass.
I checked to make sure she didn't have any candy on her hands, and then I bent down and let this little colored girl touch my hair.
The teacher's eyes assumed the dewy, faraway look she reserved for such hallmark moments.
Then, this little fudge-colored girl put her hand on my cheek and said, "Oh," she said, "I wish I could be white and pretty like you."
She paused, positioning herself on the edge of the desk as though she were posing for a portrait the federal government might use on a stamp commemorating gallantry.
The thing to remember is that more than anything in this world, those colored people wish they were white.
I wasn't buying it. This was the same teacher who, when announcing her pregnancy, said,
"I just pray that my firstborn is a boy. I'll have a boy, and then maybe later I'll have a girl. Because when you do it the other way around, there's a good chance the boy will turn out to be funny."
"Funny as in having no arms and legs?" I asked.
"That,"
the teacher said,
"is far from funny. That is tragic, and you, sir, should have your lips sewn shut for saying such a cruel and ugly thing. When I say funny, I mean funny as in..."
She relaxed her wrist, allowing her hand to dangle and flop.
"I mean funny, as in that kind of funny."
She minced across the room, but it failed to illustrate her point, as this was more or less her natural walk. A series of gambling little steps, her back held straight, giving the impression she was balancing something of value atop her empty head. My seventh period math teacher did a much better version. Snatching a purse off the back of a student's chair, he would prance around the room, batting his eyes and blowing kisses at the boy seated on the front row. "So very nice to meet you," he'd say. Fearful of drawing any attention to myself, I hooted and squawked along with the rest of the class, all the while thinking, "That's me he's talking about." If I was going to make fun of people, I had to expect a little something in return. That seemed only fair. Still, though, it bothered me that they'd found such an easy way to get a laugh. As entertainers, these teachers were nothing, zero. They could barely impersonate themselves. "Look at you," my second period gym teacher would shout, his sneakers squealing against the basketball court. "You're a pack of ladies, a group of tap-dancing queers." The other boys shrugged their shoulders or smiled down at their shoes. They reacted as if they'd been called Buddhists or vampires. Sure, it was an insult, but no one would ever mistake them for the real thing. Had they ever chanted in the privacy of their backyard temple or slept in a coffin, they would have felt the sting of recognition and shared my fear of discovery. I had never done anything with another guy and literally prayed that I never would. As much as I fantasized about it, I understood that there could be nothing worse than making it official. You'd see them on television from time to time, the homosexuals, maybe on one of the afternoon talk shows. I pictured their homes, the finicky placement of their throw rugs and sectional sofas, the magazines carefully fanned just so upon the coffee table with no wives or children to disturb their order. I imagined the pornography hidden in their closets and envisioned them powerless and sobbing as the police led them away in shackles, past the teenage boy who stood bathed in the light of the television news camera and shouted, "That's him! He's the one who touched my hair!" It was my hope to win a contest, cash in the prizes, and use the money to visit a psychiatrist who might cure me of having homosexual thoughts. Electroshock, brain surgery, hypnotism, I was willing to try anything. Under a doctor's supervision, I would buckle down and really change. I swore I would. My parents knew a couple whose son had killed a Presbyterian minister while driving drunk. They had friends whose eldest daughter had sprinkled a bundt cake with Comet, and knew of a child who, high on spray paint, had set fire to the family's cocker spaniel. Yet they spoke of no one whose son was a homosexual. The odds struck me as bizarre, but the message was the same. This was clearly the worst thing that could happen to a person. The day-to-day anxiety was bad enough without my instructors taking their feeble little pot shots. If my math teacher were able to subtract the alcohol from his diet, he'd still be on the football field where he belonged, and my Spanish teacher's credentials were based on nothing more than a long weekend in Tijuana as far as I was concerned. I quit taking their tests and completing their homework assignments, accepting Fs rather than delivering the grades I thought might promote their reputations as good teachers. It was a strategy that hurt only me, but I thought it cunning. We each had our self-defeating schemes, all of the boys I'd come to identify as homosexuals. Except for a few transfer students, I'd known most of them since the third grade. We'd spent years gathered together in cinder block offices as one speech therapist after another tried to cure us of our lisps. Had there been a walking specialist, we probably would have met there, too. These were the same boys who carried poorly forged notes to gym class and were the first to raise their hands when the English teacher asked for a volunteer to read aloud from The Yearling or Lord of the Flies. We had long ago identified one another and understood that because of everything we had in common, we could never be friends. To socialize would have drawn too much attention to ourselves. We were members of a secret society founded on self-loathing. When a teacher or a classmate made fun of a real homosexual, I made certain my laugh was louder than anyone else's. When a club member's clothing was thrown into the locker room toilet, I was always the first to cheer. When it was my clothing, I watched as the faces of my fellows broke into recognizable expressions of relief. "Faggots," I thought, "this should have been you." Several of my teachers, when discussing the upcoming school integration, would scratch at the damp stains beneath their arms, pulling back their lips to reveal every bit of tooth and gum. They made wild animal noises, a manic succession of monkey cries meant to suggest that soon our school would be no different than a jungle. Had a genuine ape been seated in the room, I guessed he might have identified their calls as a cry of panic. Anything that caused them suffering brought me joy, but I doubted they would talk this way come fall. At the end of the school year, my sister Lisa and I were excused from our volunteer jobs and sent to Greece to attend a month-long summer camp, advertised as the crown jewel of the Ionian Sea. The camp was reserved exclusively for Greek Americans and featured instruction in such topics as folk singing and something called religious prayer and flag. I despised the idea of summer camp, but longed to boast that I had been to Europe. I saw Europe as an opportunity to reinvent myself. I might still look and speak the same way, but having walked those cobblestone streets, I would be identified as continental. "He has a passport," my classmates would whisper. "Quick, let's run before he judges us." Our father accompanied us to New York, where we met our fellow campers for the charter flight to Athens. There were hundreds of them, each one confident and celebratory. They tossed their complimentary Aegean Airlines tote bags across the room, shouting and jostling one another. This would be the way I'd act once we'd finally returned from camp, but not one moment before. Were it an all-girls camp, I would have been able to work up some enthusiasm. Had they sent me alone to pry leeches off the backs of bloodthirsty pygmies, I might have gone bravely. But spending a month in a dormitory full of boys, that was asking too much. I had tried to put it out of my mind, but faced with their boisterous presence, I found myself growing progressively more hysterical. My nervous tics shifted into their highest gear, and a small crowd gathered to watch what they believed to be an exotic folk dance. If my sister was anxious about our trip, she certainly didn't show it. Prying my fingers off her wrist, she crossed the room and introduced herself to a girl who stood picking salvageable butts out of the standing ashtray. This was a tough-looking Queens native named Stephanie Hartatakis, or Testacocles. I recall only that her last name had granted her a lifelong supply of resentment. Stephanie wore mirrored aviator sunglasses and carried an oversized comb in the back pocket of her hip-hugger jeans. Of all the girls in the room, she seemed the least likely candidate for my sister's friendship. They sat beside each other on the plane, and by the time we disembarked in Athens, Lisa was speaking in a very bad Queens accent. During the long flight, while I sat cowering beside a boy named Seaman, my sister had undergone a complete physical and cultural transformation. Her shoulder-length hair was now parted on the side, covering the left half of her face as if to conceal a nasty scar. She cursed and spat, scowling out the window of the chartered bus as if she'd come to Greece with the sole intention of kicking its dusty ass.
What a shithole. Jeez, if I'd known it was going to be this hot, I would have stayed at home with my head in the oven, right, girls?
Lisa had adjusted with remarkable ease, but something deep in my stomach suggested I wouldn't thrive nearly as well. Camp lasted a month, during which time I never once had a bowel movement. I was used to having a semi-private bathroom and could not bring myself to occupy one of the men's room stalls, fearful that someone might recognize my shoes or, even worse, not see my shoes at all and walk in on me. Sitting down three times a day for a heavy Greek meal became an exercise akin to packing a musket. I told myself I'd sneak off during one of our field trips, but those toilets were nothing more than a hole in the floor, a hole I could have filled with no problem whatsoever. I considered using the Ionian Sea, but for some unexplained reason, we were not allowed to swim in those waters. The camp had an Olympic-sized pool that was fed from the sea and soon grew murky with stray bits of jellyfish that had been pulverized by the pump. The tiny tentacles raised welts on the camper's skin, so shortly after arriving, it was announced that we could photograph both the pool and the ocean, but we could swim in neither. The Greeks had invented democracy, built the Acropolis, and then called it a day. There was one boy at camp I felt I might get along with, a Detroit native named Jason who slept in the bunk beneath mine. Like me, he used his free time to curl into a fetal position, staring at the bedside calendar upon which he'd X'd out all the days he had endured so far. We were finishing our 7:15 to 7:45 wash-and-rinse segment one morning when our dormitory counselor arrived for inspection, shouting, "What are you, a bunch of goddamn faggots who can't make your beds?" I giggled out loud at his stupidity. If anyone knew how to make a bed, it was a faggot. It was the others he needed to worry about. I saw Jason laughing, too, and soon we took to mocking this counselor, referring to one another first as faggots and then as stinking faggots. We were lazy faggots and sunburnt faggots before we eventually became faggoty faggots. We couldn't protest the word, as that would have meant acknowledging the truth of it. The most we could do was embrace it as a joke. Embodying the term in all its cliched glory, we minced and pranced about the room for each other's entertainment when the others weren't looking. I found myself easily outperforming my teachers who had failed to capture the proper spirit of loopy bravado inherent to the role. Faggot, as a word, was always delivered in a harsh, unforgiving tone, befitting anyone weak or stupid enough to act upon their impulses. We used it as a joke, an accusation, and finally as a dare. Late at night, I'd feel my bunk buck and sway, knowing that Jason was either masturbating or beating eggs for an omelet. Is it me he's thinking about? I'd follow his lead and wake the next morning to find our entire iron frame unit had wandered a good 18 inches away from the wall. Our love had the power to move bunks. Having no willpower, we depended on circumstances to keep us apart. "This cannot happen" was accompanied by the sound of bed springs whining, "Oh, but maybe just this once." There came an afternoon when, running late for flag worship, we found ourselves alone in the dormitory. What started off as name-calling escalated into a series of mock angry slaps. We wrestled each other onto one of the lower bunks, both of us longing to be pinned. "You kids think you invented sex," my mother was fond of saying. But hadn't we? With no instruction manual or federally enforced training period, didn't we all come away feeling we'd discovered something unspeakably modern? What produced in others a feeling of exhilaration left Jason and me with a mortifying sense of guilt. We fled the room as if in our fumblings we had uncapped some virus we still might escape if we ran fast enough. Had one of the counselors not caught me scaling the fence, I felt certain I would have made it back to Raleigh by morning, skittering across the surface of the ocean like one of those lizards often featured on television wildlife programs. When discovered making out with one of the Greek bus drivers, a 16-year-old camper was forced to stand beside the flagpole dressed in long pants and thick sweaters. We watched her cook in the hot sun until, fully roasted, she crumpled to the pavement and passed out. "That," the chief counselor said, "is what happens to people who play around." If this was a punishment for a boy and a girl, I felt certain the penalty for two boys somehow involved barbed wire, a team of donkeys, and the nearest volcano. Nothing could match the cruelty and humiliation Jason and I soon practiced upon each other. He started a rumor that I had stolen an athletic supporter from another camper and secretly wore it over my mouth like a surgical mask. I retaliated, claiming he had expressed a desire to become a dancer. "That's nothing," he said to the assembled crowd. "Take a look at what I found on David's bed." He reached into the pocket of his tennis shorts and withdrew a sheet of notebook paper upon which were written the words, "I like guys." Presented as an indictment, the document was both pathetic and comic. Would I supposedly have written the note to remind myself of that fact, lest I forget? Had I intended to wear it taped to my back, advertising my preference the next time our rented buses carried us off to yet another swinging sexual playground? "I like guys." He held the paper above his head, turning a slow circle so that everyone might get a chance to see it. I suppose he had originally intended to plant the paper on my bunk for one of the counselors to find. Presenting it himself had foiled the note's intended effect. Rather than beating me with sticks and heavy shoes, the other boy simply groaned and looked away, wondering why he'd picked the thing up and carried it around in his pants pocket. Touching such a foul document made him suspect and guilty by association. In attempting to discredit each other, we wound up alienating ourselves even further. I watched as he befriended a girl named Theodora and held her hand during a screening of A Lovely Way to Die, one of the cave paintings a head counselor offered as a weekly movie. "She wasn't a bad person, Theodora. Someday the doctors might find a way to transplant a calf's brain into a human skull, and then she'd be just as lively and intelligent as he was. I tried to find a girlfriend of my own, but my one possible candidate was sent back home when she tumbled down the steps of the Parthenon, causing serious damage to her leg brace." Jason looked convincing enough in the company of his girlfriend. They scrambled about the various ruins, snapping each other's pictures while I hung back fuming, watching them nuzzle and coo. My jealousy stemmed from the belief that he had been cured. One fistful of my flesh and he had lost all symptoms of the disease. Camp ended and I flew home with my legs crossed. Once there, I dropped my bag of stolen souvenirs and raced to the bathroom, where I spent the next several days sitting on the toilet and studying my face in a hand mirror. "I like guys." The words had settled themselves into my features. I was a professional now, and it showed. I returned to the volunteer job I held at the local mental hospital. carrying harsh Greek cigarettes as an incentive to some of the more difficult patients.
Faggot!
A woman shouted, stooping to protect her collection of pine cones.
Get your faggoty hands away from my radio transmitters!
Don't mind Mary Elizabeth, the orderly said. She's crazy. Maybe not, I thought, holding a pine cone up against my ear. She'd gotten the faggot part right, so maybe she was on to something. The moment we boarded our return flight from Kennedy to Raleigh, Lisa rearranged her hair, dropped her accent, and turned to me, saying,
Well, I thought that was very nice. How about you?
Over the course of 5 minutes, she had eliminated all traces of her reckless European self. Why couldn't I do the same? In late August, my class schedule arrived, along with the news that I would not be bussed. There had been violence in other towns and counties. Trouble as far away as Boston, but in Raleigh the transition had been peaceful. Not only students, but many of the teachers had been shifted from one school to another. My new science teacher was a black man, very adept at swishing his way across the room, mocking everyone from Albert Einstein to the dweebish host of a popular children's television program. Black and white, the teachers offered their ridicule as though it were an olive branch. Here, they said, this is something we each have in common, proof that we're all brothers under the skin. Ashes. The moment I realized I would be a homosexual for the rest of my life, I forced my brother and sisters to sign a contract swearing they'd never get married. There was a clause allowing them to live with anyone of their choice just so long as they never made it a